produce simultaneously a type of instructor who usually is called forth by emergency. In the Bhagavad Gita, Vishnu is made to say, when virtue fails upon the earth, then I come forth. Now, at the time of Pythagoras, Greek culture was young. At the time of Zoroaster, the last Zoroaster, if he flourished 600 BC, Persian culture was old. At the time of Buddha, we can say that Hinduism was decadent. At the time of Confucius and Laozi in China, we know that Chinese history was comparatively young and the culture comparatively strong. Therefore, we cannot say that these men appeared to read obituary rituals over the deaths of peoples, nor can we say that, like the seers of old, they came to stand at the cradle of new cultures. This cannot be said. What then do we find as the common denominator? The common denominator appears to be that all of these groups, young or old, were afflicted with certain limitations and internal corruptions. These men all moved against what might be termed man's inhumanity to man. They moved against the tyranny of privileged groups and the suppression of the rights of individuals. Buddha fought to overcome a caste system in India that was a strong slavery of the later world. Laozi was completely disillusioned with the mental, spiritual life of China. Confucius was seeking a restoration of just government for his people and the establishment of a higher level of cultural education, not only for the masses but for their leaders. Pythagoras came at a time which was a transition in the entire life of Greek thinking, because he emerged with the rise of the sophists, or the professional educators of Greece, and was in strong rebellion against the commercialization of education. Each one had his own particular problem with which he was working. But that all these different problems should link together to produce this peculiar historical cycle is, to say the least, interesting and significant. It is a series of coincidences which have not since been repeated. And yet we do have repetitions of other kinds that are stimulating to us. For example, the tremendous emphasis upon music in the 18th and 19th centuries, the great rise of arts in the Renaissance, and the extension of various cultural motions which come to climactic periods and then decline. There seems, therefore, to be a time and place for everything under the sun. But these times and places appear to be more than accidental. They represent some kind of a definite pattern, a pattern which seems to tell us that human beings get into major trouble as groups about every six centuries. They get into a situation from which it does not seem that they can easily extricate themselves. Or they reach a critical point in which, did they continue, would lead to the premature disintegration of their civilization. It is quite possible that had not Pythagoras become the great spokesman of Greek learning that the golden age of Pericles could not have followed? For we do realize that it was the tremendous shift to a philosophical basis which he instituted that became the impetus, or bestowed the impetus, upon the great rise of philosophy in the Greek states, resulting in about 600 years of philosophy in Greece. Philosophy which definitely continued until the final disintegration of the original academy and the falling apart of Greek national existence under the inroads of the Roman Empire. Now, it's interesting also to note that the last Greek philosopher is said to have died 680, which would be again one of these climactic periods. Therefore, that it took considerable time for the final disintegration of the direct impetus of these schools. The contribution made by Buddha, beginning in the 6th century and extending through the long years of his own life, continued down with comparatively slight change till about the beginning of the Christian era. 600 years after Buddha rose the great reformations which have been attributed to Sankaracharya. And these reformations resulted in the complete shift of Buddhism and the rise of the Mahayana, or Great Vehicle. And the principal leaders of that Great Vehicle movement were contemporaries of Jesus and lived 600 years after Pythagoras. Thus, the peculiar involvement of these dates becomes important. Another important point that I think we should realize, and which perhaps has lost a little of its validity in our modern thinking, is that in antiquity, the great changes that were to be noted in the descent of man are always upon the levels of religion and philosophy. Nations rise and fall, states come and go, kings overthrew each other, but the major motion in those periods were not the result of war or the result of the corruption of dynasty, except indirectly. The great changes were due to the rise of individuals who made positive claim to revelational insight, or who claimed a ministry, or claimed a right to contribute to the spiritual enlightenment of their fellow men. Thus, at the time we mention, and also at the time of the beginning of the Christian era, the principal motions originated in man's religious convictions. These were the motions which made way for education to rise. I think we should therefore say that 600 years B.C. approximately dates the beginning of man's formal concept of education. It is assumed generally, historically, that the Academy of Pythagoras at Crotona was the first formal educational institution in the Mediterranean area. There is much to indicate that the school of Confucius was the first broad, comprehensive curriculum of education introduced in China. And we know definitely that it was from Buddhism and its emancipating influence upon the public mind that the great university systems of India received their greatest impulse, and the most famous institution of learning in the ancient world, the University of Nalanda, came into being. Thus, the 600 B.C. date has in most instances been directly associated with religion as educational liberation. are friends of that period, with the possible exception of Lao Tzu. Were not essentially mystics. They were essentially teachers. And even Lao Tzu was a librarian of the libraries of the Chu, the highest intellectual position in China. These men were essentially teachers, not preachers. They came with spiritual authority, but their idea of religion was comprehensive. In this era, there was no division between man's religious insight, his arts and his sciences and his crafts. In these days, the total enlightenment of man was in the keeping of the ancient teachers. And the spiritual leader was also the grammarian, the mathematician, the astronomer, and in many cases, in fact usually, the physician. The records, for instance, left by Pythagoras give us some realization of the broad scope of the man's achievement. He is remembered, of course, for his magnificent contribution to mathematics, particularly the great 47th proposition or Pythagorean proposition in geometry. He is remembered for his researches in astronomy and cosmogony. He is accredited with the discovery of the diatonic scale in music. He is recognized as one of the earliest exponents of the formal type of poetry, particularly the use of the hexameter meter. He is known as a physician and an expert on color, number, and many other subjects. He was a man of universal learning. For in these days, leadership in philosophy implied achievement in astronomy, mathematics, and music. And Pythagoras was a musician. Confucius was a musician. And these men, in no sense of the word, could be regarded as limited to what we might term a theological religious perspective. They had no such restriction upon themselves. All learning was their scope. In a large measure, the same thing is true of Buddha. And we find frequent references in the ancient Buddhistic writings to his attainments in other subjects than that which we regard as associated with him, philosophy and religion. We know that the last of the Zoroasters was regarded as a man of exceptional attainments in medicine and in many other fields of learning. Thus we have a synthetic approach rather than an analytical one. And we find the outpouring of streams of intellectual energy aimed at preserving and sustaining the security of peoples. We have these men, and at the same period, the rise of the great lawgivers of Greece, Solon, Pitarchus, Periander, Cleobulus, the men who gave to Greece its great codes of law. We also have rising in China great systems of legislative code. And in this period also, the rise of Chinese and Indian astronomy. They were rich periods of outpouring. And these outpourings became the strength of the various cultural groups. India remained essentially sound in its Buddhistic teaching for approximately 600 years. China enjoyed the great mystical revelation of Lao Tzu until about the beginning of the Christian era, when mysticism in this field began to move into other manifestations. Taoism is divided into three distinct periods. These periods corresponding again in timing with the Phoenix cycle. From From these various considerations, we come to a major one, therefore. Namely, that for some reason, nearly every work of man must be subjected to powerful revitalization periodically. Today, we will say, in all probability, that necessity produced the sage. That in some way, it was the emergency in man's own nature that called upon his own brother man to rise and meet that need. I doubt if the ancients would have argued with this point of view, but they would also have pointed out that history, being the sequential unfolding record of events, that history in some mysterious way frames this pattern of needs, distinguishes them, this pattern, as though rungs upon a ladder, and that history, therefore, is an integrated organism, that history is not a record of incidents or accidents, but a continuous report of the unfolding of basic and immutable laws, that these laws are under the control of cyclic energy. And we can gain certain sympathy in this thinking from Spengler's work on the decline of the West. In this work, Oswald Spengler points out that all great civilizations are cyclic, that civilizations are therefore composite human beings. And as man passes through birth, growth, infancy, maturity, and decline, so cultures have great cyclic patterns, moving inevitably from their humble beginnings, beginnings with tremendous energy and little experience, to their ends, which is greatness of experience and exhaustion of energy. That things die of fatigue, and that when institutions die, a psychochemistry takes place. Institutions are merely hypothetical boundaries on the continuance of the unbroken stream of human life itself. It may be that a pattern is exhausted, but the persons living in that pattern must in many instances survive it, and must pass through what we call transition periods, periods of moving from one pattern into another. Thus, every 600 years, the human being confronts a personal emergency. The personal emergency is not the collapse of a cycle. The emergency is the danger that he himself will collapse with it, his inability to face transition. We find this even in the shorter cycle of human life, where it is estimated that very few persons are able to maintain individuality of thought, emotion, and action after the 50th year. By that time, the pressure of circumstances, disillusionments, and the gradual depletion of energies results in the individual taking cover in some form, hiding under something, seeking protection, and gradually passing the reins of progress on to someone else. He finds that it is increasingly difficult for him to maintain the momentum of progress. He sees it move by him and becomes a stranger in his own world. Now, every 600 years, according to this ancient calculation, great masses of human beings are confronted with this matter of transition period. These masses of human beings are of all ages individually. The transition may strike one person in childhood and another in maturity and another in advanced years. because the transition represents an arbitrary pattern of climaxes. Now, we like to think of the fact, and often refer to the fact, that we are living perpetually in transition. We are. But we look back over, for instance, the 19th century. The last half of it, certainly, was, for most persons, a comparatively tranquil period. Not tranquil, perhaps, in terms of their personal existences, but tranquil in terms of comparatively low taxes, comparative freedom of action, and the ability to live their lives, if in a somewhat humble manner, much according to the dictates of their own consciences or according to the circumstances which they themselves had created. Now we come into this century and observe the individual more and more the victim of mass motions over which he has no authority. Therefore, we may say that he appears to be approaching a climactic period. Yet this climactic period may be only one of the lesser transitional situations that he has to face. Certainly, there is continual transition. But there come times when these transitions heap together, forming such tremendous patterns that they require an almost complete reorientation of a way of life. Later we will observe that the beginning of the Christian era, also one of these 600-year points, was perhaps in the earlier periods of things the greatest and most dynamic of these transition periods. A transition between two ways of life that were never to meet again, that were never to have even valid relationships after they once separated at that time. So here we have what might be termed in the 6th century BC the emergence of integrated human record. By some very strange circumstance, also perhaps difficult to classify but obvious, the year 600 BC is often chosen by historians arbitrarily to represent what they consider the beginning of trustworthy, detailed chronological descent of events. From 600 BC to the present time, we have an almost unbroken historical record. There are flaws in it, and there are weak points. But never do we get into the same dilemma again that existed in the year 700 BC, when we have almost no records of any kind. There was a broad dividing line. Why? Obviously, because the training of men's minds under the impact of the philosophic system began to produce the type of thinking which related events and also prepared for the more conscientious effort to explore history in terms of the mental and moral life of individuals. It was not until about 600 BC that we begin to find historical records of common people, if we want to call them that. Those uncommon individuals whose lives consisted only of ordinary circumstances, untouched by the great motions and glamours of high office. We begin at 600 BC to meet the farmer, the merchant. We begin to see emerging for us the little businessman. We have some contact with the musician, the artist, even the clown. We find the petty politician who never got anywhere coming out as a person. And we also find the interesting emergence of theater and the beginning of a psychological analysis of the foibles of human nature. We find men like Aristippus, and we find playwrights ridiculing the fallacies and foolishness of mortals. We see them picking on characteristics and doing so in those happy days without fear of lawsuit. At that time, human character was in public domain, and you could say anything that you could get away with. Thus, whereas in the 10th or 12th centuries we are told that a certain king or a certain prince overthrew his enemies and built a monument to his own victory, or we hear that the priests of Delphi, one of the more common type of records, in that year reported a certain number of healings or a certain number of oracles, or that navigators brought back their spices from the Far East. We hear a few things of this nature. But on this side of the year 600, we hear of nagging families, delinquent children, fussy ancestors. We begin to hear of private lawsuits, of the individual who dared to differ with authority, the person who appears in the petty courts to solve a grievance. He is only a shadow, it is true, but he is there. So we begin to have the history of peoples. We begin to have the history of the little individual and his place in the large picture. We also begin to gain considerable information, as Wilkinson points out. For the first time, we begin to know what people wore, what kind of shoes they had on. We learn a little of the trinkets that they wore, and we learn the secrets of Greek and Egyptian cosmetics, and also vital statistics on the brewing of beer. We get all kinds of things that we did not know anything about before. So on this side of that critical point, humanity as we know it today comes into view. Now, it could not have come into view and would have been meaningless had not this division period resulted in the rise of what we term today acute observationalism. Our philosophers began to accept the challenge of the Egyptian, who said that the proper study for mankind is man. So attention began to be turned upon man. And from the sheer contemplation of divine matters and a recording of the activities of Olympian deities, history begins to take on the coloring of the human being, his relationship to history, and his relationship to the changing patterns of the day in which he lived. From this date, therefore, we must theoretically found our observational psychology. For we know that at that time the records were established, the analyses were made, the clinical observations were recorded, which made possible the work of men like Freud, Adler, and Jung. For from that time on, we begin to see a human being moved by compulsions, harassed by neuroses, burdened with frustrations, and valiantly struggling to adjust himself to the insecurity of his own internal life. Thus the emphasis upon all these elements of growth and the almost complete obscuration of politics. What do we know today, for example, actually, of the politics of Greece during the age of Grecian philosophy? We know almost nothing and care less. We know the archons were not all they should have been, but we took that for granted. We realize that in this period, the great heroes were the thinkers, the creators, and that we are indebted to them for the mysterious rise of many systems of exact thought which we have built upon, but which we did not invent. The origin being in those earlier and perhaps less chronicled, but reasonably well-defined years. Thus, a great change did take place. And among the Egyptians, the attitude was held that there were streams of energy moving behind history. The history is the account of the physiological functions of one collective living entity. The history is the record of the life of an entity. That entity being composed of all living things functioning during that period or existing under that pattern. When the Egyptians formed their statue of Serapis at Alexandria, they composed its body by mingling together every known element and substance, so that plants, animals, minerals, everything that man knew to exist, all these parts were fitted together into a strange and cunning contrivance and constituted the body of this deity. This deity is therefore a kind of historical personification, because history is the story of the life in the rock and the shell. What we call geology is only a kind of history. Anthropology is a kind of history. And this entire pattern is actually, finally, only the report of the motion of energy. History is therefore the account of what energy does, how it does it, and when it does it. History is consequently actually concerned not primarily with persons or even events, but with motion. And motion itself is a primary attribute of life. Life moving. Now, life in its motion, in everything that lives and moves, is subject to the law of alternation. Everything that lives comes and goes, wakes and sleeps, lives and dies, grows and decays. Just as the annual story of the tree, which in winter drops its leaves and appears dead, so, as Plato has pointed out, the great motions of energy are tidal. And these tidal motions mean that the flow of energy through the sequence which we call history is not continuously the same. That there are periods in which energy is superiorly abundant, and there are other periods in which energy is deficient. And wherever energy is abundant, motion and the qualitative consequences of motion, these are themselves abundant, or as the Greek said, luxuriant. In a luxuriant period, there is an unfolding and releasing of life. Just as the individual feeling well on Monday turns out a great day's work, and being a little weary of a Thursday does not do so well. So, if energy is abundant, according to the qualitative concept of the ancient, if the great tidal motion of energy is flowing, then there is a simultaneous release of vitality. Now, in many parts and levels of the world. Obviously, such release is again conditioned. The individual may feel very good, but if he has few abilities, he may still accomplish little. Whereas another man, not feeling even quite so well, may accomplish more because of having additional abilities and resources in himself. Therefore, a release of energy into organism or organization does not mean that all of these energized areas will react simultaneously or identically. But it does mean that there will be more energy available than at other times, and that this energy released in highly cultured peoples will result in strong cultural motions, and released perhaps only through a warlike people may result in additional militarism or activity on that level. Also, in those epochs or eras in which energy is deficient, when the great tidal motions are ebbing, there will be a corresponding diminution of available resources. And this diminution, according to the Greeks, is notable first in the most sensitive areas of man's cultural existence. Therefore, wherever energy is involved, its depletion means that the best dies first. That which represents the use of the most subtle energies will first feel any change in the motions of those energies. That which requires the most balanced vitality to maintain its own equilibrium will be the first affected. Just as we may say that the most sensitive and highly cultivated plant may be the first to feel the frost. The weed will live for a long time, but that which depends upon a highly sensitized environment may be quickly blighted. So the decline of civilization, as the Egyptians pointed out, is always measured by the failure of creative idealism on the level of leadership. The greater incentives fail. And as the greater leader fails in the collective, so the greater faculty of leadership is the first to fail in the individual. Under a blight, therefore, ideals, inspirations, creativity, these are the first to suffer. So that we find wherever energy has this diminishing factor notable within it, that the grosser parts survive the longest. And therefore, that a soul may perish in one century, but the body may not die for one, two, or three centuries more. Just also as the decline in organization may result in senility, in which the body may endure, but the faculties are no longer capable of active function. So a people, passing from acuteness of maturity to the senility of age, first grow irrational, even though for a time the body may appear to be healthy. Philosophy has therefore observed that it is the failure of the rational factor which must herald the ultimate disintegration of the physical structure. And this they point out through the long ascent of historical record. If, as Plato has told us, the great year consists then of these periods of fertility and sterility, we have the factor that is also paralleled in the Hindu concept of the Kali Yuga. We have in this period a loss of energies, a diminution of vitalities. The Hindu tells us, of course, that the great cycle of messianic dispensations or avatars, that this cycle is always associated with the Kali Yuga, because it is in this period that man becomes incapable of the solution of his own problem. And it is therefore during this period that intercession is emphasized in religion. The laws of certain energies make it necessary, or at least highly important, that man be continually brought back as far as possible to the reintegration of his psychic life. In a period which is not the Kali Yuga, man will not fall into these patterns of ignorance, and therefore does not need to be lifted out of them by any particular requirement. Assuming, for example, the Greek legend of the Golden Age, when everyone lived together happily, peacefully, and in continual bliss, it would hardly be necessary at such time for intercession to prevent the individual from collapsing. Thus, we would not need reformers unless men themselves fall away from law. We do not need revelation unless man has lost the power to know himself and to understand the roots of his own spiritual integrity. Thus, the year 3000 BC in the Hindu calendar would mark the beginning of the age of the avatars, because it would mark the need or the beginning of the pattern in which man must be instructed from some level of consciousness beyond his own immediate availability. So history would move from that pattern. Now, as these things go from their various sequences, if we are dealing with the Phoenix cycle, we know that this cycle does not end in death, that the Phoenix cycle ends always with the concept of resurrection. We must therefore also realize that energy moving through the body of history may, like the phoenix, have only one body at a time, because it is a collective thing. It is using all body. But that the phoenix is never unembodied. For when its time comes to die, it builds its own nest of flames and perishes on it, which might be another way of stating the old phrase that we make our own beds and then have to lie in them. In other words, we have a strange historical peculiarity of how civilizations disappear in flames of some kind. Not fire as we see it, but in the holocausts of the collapse of great cultural motions, which usually lead to temporary pandemonium. But before its actual death, or at the moment of death, the body of the dead bird breaks open and the young newborn phoenix is liberated to fly to the altar of the sun at Heliopolis and pay offerings and tribute to the great gods. The great gods being, in this case, of course, the symbols of the great universal laws that cannot be violated. So the death of the phoenix is always a birth process. And the great critical periods of historical dissolution have always been periods not only of the throes of death, but of the travail of birth. Things are born out of death forever, even as creativity is born out of dissolution. And the greatest hope of man is born from his deepest despair. Thus, in the Phoenix cycle, all of the things which ended with the death of the old Phoenix were brought forth and made new by the restoration of the new Phoenix. In this case, the rise of the great era of the teachers, who become the embodiments or personifications of the Phoenix cycle, or the Phoenix energy. If we study the period of 600 BC,
you will see how a great tradition, about 600 years old and in its own infirmity, had reached the point where it could no longer sustain progress, where it could no longer liberate man from the psychological pressure of tradition. So just as the ancient American Indian in Central America burned all his records every 52 years and declared himself free from the past, so every so often, in this holocaust of the death of the phoenix, man must burn the bridges of tradition by which he limits and restricts his own action. We see this also in the problem of personal living. By the time the individual reaches 60 or 70 years of age, he has worked himself into a pattern from which he can no longer escape, except in a very small minority of cases, and from which death is his only release. It's his only opportunity for a fresh start at anything. Nations, cultures, peoples, religions work themselves into these patterns where crystallization under the name of tradition locks motion and causes this great sea of energy, this great current of energy, this irresistible force to come head on into an immovable object. The immovable object being the crystallization that sets in around any idea in the course of 6 centuries. A man has an idea, and 600 years later, the world is locked by that idea. Man hasn't realized that ideas must be perpetually new. We cannot live by the ideas of the past. We can use them. But if we say, this was revealed infallibly and inevitably, and to this we must abide, 600 years from now, that law, that rule, will be a complete prison upon us, locking us utterly. So that in 600 years, the phoenix grows old, the law grows old, the dispensation grows old, the institution grows old. And man must either die with it, or else the institution must break and die for man, releasing man from itself. Thus, the death of the phoenix also definitely represents the breaking of these cyclic patterns. And this is usually accomplished by a reformation, by the arising of individuals with new and important viewpoints, breaking through tradition and usually dying themselves at the hands of tradition. They may not actually die physically, but they are certainly opposed by tradition. Pythagoras was a martyr to it. Later, so was Socrates. Confucius regarded himself as a heartbroken failure, because he was never able to break the tradition in which his life was patterned. Lao Tzu walked out on the tradition completely, and riding on a green ox went out into the Gobi Desert to die as the lesser of two evils. Buddha, for 83 years, struggled with the tradition. He was perhaps the most fortunate of them all. Zarathustra Spitama died in Persia with an assassin's spear in his back. Thus the phoenix dies, the bird dies in flames, but is born again. Constantly death giving birth to life. But against the tremendous weight of tradition rises the mysterious symbol of martyrdom, which is the greatest tradition-breaking force of all time. The great religions are nearly always associated with martyrdom. They represent a pattern by means of which man is released, breaks through, develops a new conscience mechanism, and starts out on another cycle, which will in turn grow old and hold him in bondage
at the end of another 600 years. It seems to take in the world of events that length of time for a common social motion to pass through the seven ages of its existence. Coming in the end, after the 6 days of labor, or the 6 centuries, to a Sabbath of rest, it can no longer go on. Now, if we took history and studied it in this light, it would be quite possible to fill in innumerable details and begin to see the tremendous chemistry of motion meeting obstacle, the tremendous psychological chemistry which results in the emergence of these great energized persons who become the custodians of new ways and become the leaders of the next phoenix cycle. These leaders in turn, or those who come after them, must in due course take their own aging bodies back to the altar of the sun and there voluntarily die that a new age may be born. Therefore, greatness voluntarily dies in order that it may forever release man from bondage to greatness and push man forward to the emancipation of his own consciousness. Later, other factors appear to take on coloring, and the essential religious elements are not so obvious. But in all the periods prior to the Christian era, and including it, these great changes have been identified almost completely with spiritual leadership. With the coming of the Christian era, we see, again, the tremendous emphasis upon the escape of the individual from a tradition, an old way that had once been new and beautiful, had gradually been corrupted by the decadence of man until it began to take a stranglehold upon the freedom of human consciousness. Then it was that it was necessary to whip the money changers from the steps of the temple. Then it was that the veil had to be rent and the earth torn, at least in the great symbolical account. For again, the individual had to be freed from the negative phase of history, which is tradition. Now, tradition can be good or bad. Tradition which inspires us is the source of great good. Tradition which captures us and holds us, limits us, is a great danger. And all tradition begins by inspiring and ends by enslaving. So man must continually renew the principles of his life. Each of these great cycles, therefore, is involved in making all things new again, in order that the individual may once more experience the dynamic of free action, free choice, voluntary decision. As soon as he has decided for himself, he begins to decide for others. And the moment he decides for others, his culture begins to die. The moment he denies to another the right he demands for himself, he begins to lock and enslave. This is the story of history. This is the part of history which we cannot forget. This is the part of history which we must explore down through the various cycles with which we are concerned. So next week we are going to psychoanalyze historically probably the greatest era that we know, the beginning of the Christian era, and the effects of it upon the world which was to come after.